item number 15, report and possible discussion on legislative update by Matt Phillips, Legislative and Governmental Affairs Manager.
Thank you. So I'm going to kind of go through what's going on with the session. I'll say that I stand before you all as a man who's big enough to admit when he's wrong. In January, I told a lot of you that the leadership was in lockstep on working on a few issues like property taxes and education reform, and that I really thought that they had turned a corner and were going to get it done and everything was going to be fine and everybody was going to get along. And I don't know what in my many years of legislative experience made me naively believe that that was the case, because it's really not. And we're to a point in session where a lot of those big issues seem to be falling off the rails. And the reason that's problematic is, you know, while we're focused on some smaller issues that hit closer to home for us and our operations, those larger issues kind of set the tone for the entirety of the session. They can grind everything to a halt, and they very well could force the need for a special session, which is looking more and more likely every day, particularly for public ed reform and school tax reform. So I think that there's a very good chance they could be back during the summer unless they can figure something out between now and then. They all agree that something needs to be done on all these issues. They just don't agree with how. So that's kind of the broad 30,000-foot view of the larger issues that are kind of moving through the session. Oddly enough, they're pretty close together on the budget, which is the only thing they really have to do. So I think they'll pass that. But then they might get called back for some of these other issues, maybe in June or July. So I'm going to spend some time talking about the issues that we're more focused on. I say this every time I do on these updates. This is by no means an exhaustive list of everything that we're looking at. It's kind of a snapshot of some of the issues. We've got a tracking list of thousands of bills. But these are some of the ones that have kind of floated to the top and are really, for the most part, the ones I'll talk about are at least moving, have been voted out of committee. They're not completely dead at this point, so there's a chance that any one of these could pass. On the flood front, each house has passed its kind of package of flood-related bills. The House has passed House Bill 5, 13, and 26, and the Senate's passed Senate Bills 6, 7, and 8. They all do some pretty similar things. They just do them in different ways. House Bill 5 and Senate Bill 6 are very similar in that they're mainly related to emergency management training, and they set up committees to look at debris removal. So they don't require any specific entity to do debris removal. That was a concern of ours. We didn't want to be pinned with that job for a basin the size of Tennessee. We do not have the resources to do that in every tributary of the Brazos River. So they set up a committee to look at debris removal. What's the process for it? Who will be responsible for it? So we'll watch and see what comes out of that. House Bill 13 and Senate Bill 7 are both bills that set up a flood infrastructure fund. They set up a fund to fund flood mitigation projects now and in the future. For our purposes, they're not bad bills in that they don't mandate our involvement. They don't mandate our cooperation. We can choose to involve ourselves in those types of projects under both bills if we wanted to. And there may be instances where we do want to get involved in a flood project that has an associated water supply benefit similar to the core reservoirs that we have in our basin. So that may be something we look at, but it doesn't mandate it. So we're obviously much happier with the way that those turned out, because that was a concern. House Bill 26 doesn't have a Senate companion. It requires us as dam operators to notify emergency operations centers in downstream counties of our dams when we're making releases. We already do this, but it then requires those emergency operations folks to notify the public of a whole host of different information, such as, you know, if there's going to be potential flooding, where to watch out for potential flooding, if there's going to be roads and bridges out. It goes through a whole list of stuff that the emergency operations centers are going to be responsible for notifying people of. We will not be responsible for that. We notify the EOCs, they notify the people. So we're perfectly happy with that arrangement in terms of dam release notification. Senate Bill 8 is the state flood plan. That creates a state flood planning process similar to the regional water planning process. So it's a process we're very familiar with. It's one that we would be involved in this state flood plan. I'm sure we would be part of one of multiple regions that would look at individual regions, trying to look at what are flood projects that would work to mitigate flooding in that region. And then you send those to the Water Development Board, you develop a state flood plan, and you use that plan to fund projects and implement them throughout the basin. Oddly enough, while Senate Bill 8 has a very, very detailed setup for what a state flood plan would entail in terms of laying out who's on the regions and what the regions will look like and what they're supposed to look at, House Bill 13 actually has state flood plan language in it, but it basically just says the Water Development Board will establish a state flood plan in coordination with rules that the board adopts. It's literally one sentence, so that's all it says. So both houses have passed a version of a state floodplain. It's just one's much more detailed than the other. House Bill 13 and Senate Bill 8 also both include a requirement that the State Soil and Water Conservation Board do a study on their dams. These are what we call the dirt board dams. They're the small earthen dams, many of which don't have a dam maintenance plan. Nobody's looked at them in many, many years. And so they require the Soil and Water Conservation Board to inspect and create a dam maintenance plan for all of those dams. The thing that concerned us with that is some of the initial language could have been interpreted to allow them to do that type of process for all dams in the state. We're already highly regulated by TCEQ, federal government. We don't need the Soil Board looking at our dams, nor should they want to look at our dams because they, you know, would kind of be out of their depth in looking at the type of things that we operate. House Bill 13 and Senate Bill 8 both have provisions to look at earthen dams and do dam maintenance plans for them. In terms of where all these things are, both sides have passed, again, their flood bill packages and have sent them over to the other side, and the other side's ignoring them. They're not looking at each other's flood bills for whatever reasons. I think that there's a lot of discussion about whose name's gonna end up on the final bills and whether they're gonna be Senate bills or House bills. I mean, to be quite honest with you, that's kind of the gamesmanship that's going on right now in terms of what bills will ultimately end up passing that are gonna take care of this flooding issue or look at taking care of it in the future. If I were a betting man, which I've been wrong before, but I would think that Senate Bill 8 is going to move. Senate Bill 6 or House Bill 5, since they're so similar, are going to move. And then House Bill 13, which sets up the Flood Infrastructure Fund, will move, but it will come closer to looking like Senate Bill 7. So I think that's what will end up happening, but time will tell. We'll see in the next couple of weeks. The last piece of information I'll give with these is none of these contain provisions that require us to change our operations or do pre-releasing or any of that kind of stuff. We've been very diligent about making sure that they don't, and so that's good. All right. Surface water. Been a very unexciting session on surface water. There's very little going on. Update of water availability models. That's something that we support. House Bill 723 has passed the House. It's over in the Senate. They had a hearing on it the other day. It's going to require TCEQ to update the WAMs, starting with the Brazos. So that's a process that we'll be engaged in whenever they get to that point. What always kills this is funding. Right now, I do believe there is funding in one version of the budget to do this. We'll see if it survives. And then expedited water right amendments, that sets up a process at TCEQ to move water right amendments faster and without notice when they're minor. So if you're moving a diversion point on a example, if you're moving a diversion point on a contiguous piece of property for the same water right and it doesn't get in between another existing diversion point, then it allows you to move that process faster. If you're changing the use of a water right but not the consumptive nature of the water right, so you wouldn't be authorizing the use of more water, it allows you to get a quicker water right amendment. This is something that made it really far through the process last session and died at the end on the calendar. So it's something that'll move. We may take advantage of that process at some point in the future. We'll see. But it's a good bill. It'll at least help them move these smaller amendments faster. Groundwater. Been a very busy session on groundwater, as it usually is. I won't go through every single one of these because a lot of these, particularly 700 numbers, our bills that passed last session and belong to Representative Lyle Larson and were vetoed by the governor for a variety of reasons, unrelated to their policy implications, quite frankly. But none of them are particularly problematic. These two, 726 and 1066, both and Senate Bill 800, both of those contain some pretty decent changes in groundwater regulations. 726 doesn't allow groundwater districts to adopt moratoriums on issuance of permits without a public process. Right now, they can just adopt moratoriums and no longer issue permits, so now they're going to have a public process for that. It requires something that's in 1066 and 800, and then it requires transport permits to be extended for as long as you have an operating permit. So it syncs up operation permits with transport permits. What good is an operations permit if your transport permit expires before your operations permit does? So it seeks to sync up those two things. I think those two or three have a relatively decent chance of passing because they got pretty far in the process last session. Loser pays, that basically implements loser pays on groundwater district lawsuits. So groundwater districts will have to pay attorney's fees if they lose. Right now they don't. They don't like this bill. One of them, when I say one's light and one's less light, this one limits damages to 100,000. This one limits them to like 300,000. So one of them just got a higher limit on damages. And then another one that has a relatively good chance of passing is groundwater district rules over a common aquifer. If you've got multiple districts over one aquifer, it requires them to adopt similar rules in terms of how they permit, how long they permit, how much water they'll permit. That one's running into some trouble over in the House, but it is moving. Contracting bills. There's a lot of these this session as well. I would say a lot of them are less than good. Probably a nice way for me to put it. We don't really particularly like all of them. Some of the ones that stand out the most are limits on retainage. There's versions of this bill that limit retainage to anywhere from 3 to 5%. That's much lower than we tend to do, so we're not particularly fond of that one. House Bill 1999 is probably one of these that has the best chance of passing. It's the right to repair bill. It basically says that you have to give a contractor the ability or the right to repair defects before you take them to court. So there's a chance that that one may get there. It passed out of the House this past week, so it's over in the Senate. Contingency fees for legal services. Statutes of repose, I probably should have taken that one off. That one's not going to move. But contingency fee for legal services. This is one that sets up this really complex and difficult process for an entity to enter into a contingency fee for legal services. You have to have an agenda item, a public vote, provide a justification as to why you can't do the service in-house. Basically, it has your legal team have to get up here and say why they're inept at being able to do their jobs and why they need to hire somebody on a contingency basis. It's a really long, drawn-out process. It is mainly directed at school districts that are being solicited by trial lawyers to hire them on a contingency fee basis. It's not really directed at us, but we're a public entity, so we're caught up in it. So we're watching that one. This one right here we actually just talked about in our policies. Right now, we have to go to the comptroller and get approval for a contingency fee for legal services. This moves that approval process over to the attorney general, so it's fine. It just changes who we have to send it to. And I do think that one has a very good chance of passing as well because the comptroller requested it. Public information bills, several of these this session. Trying to think of probably the biggest one that really matters for us. Disclosure of contracting information, that's trying to deal with the Supreme Court case where public entities were trying to claim proprietary nature of things in order to keep it from disclosure, so it opens up a little bit of that. We would be required to divulge more information even if the private entity that we were contracting with didn't want us to. The law would require us to. So there are private folks that aren't particularly very happy with that one, but it is moving. And then public information held on private devices, that's kind of a big one. It really does, you know, kind of stipulate that the information held on a private device, even if it's a current or former employee, is public information and the public can access it, and it sets up a process for us to have to go get it if that were to happen. It's a pretty difficult process, but it's one that we would have to go through if that bill passes and we're required to get that kind of information. The one thing that bill does do is it allows you to designate an email address or a public address through which all of your public info requests have to come, and if they don't come through there, then you don't have to deal with them. I guess that's just an efficiency thing. We already pretty much do that. Most of ours come through. We have a button on our website that allows you to submit a public info request, so I don't know that that'll really change too much for us, but we'll see. Open meetings bills. I only put 2527 up here for fun. They're starting to require video and audio of water district public meetings. This is something that we've done for years. We obviously live feed on YouTube, but there are a lot of entities that don't. And so, again, whenever we did it, you know, we kind of made it very clear that this is the way of the future. We need to go ahead and get ready for this, and obviously it's starting to happen that they're going to require it for most, if not all, public districts. And then the walking quorum bill, we sent an email out about this to you all. Whenever the walking quorum provision of the statute, that's when members meet in numbers less than a quorum to circumvent the open meetings law. It was struck down by the Supreme Court saying it was too vague. There are two bills to try to make it less vague. You know, I would tell you that they are pretty prescriptive in what they're trying to say the new walking quorum law will be. I do think that's probably going to pass. I don't know that it changes anything for us because we do everything we can to not violate that law as it existed already. We didn't think that it was unconstitutionally vague, really. I mean, we thought it was pretty clear. You just try not to do it and you won't have a problem. So I don't think that'll change anything for us. Lobby bills. These are fun. House Bill 281 prohibits expenditure of public money for lobbying activities by entities that impose ad valorem taxes. So that one does not affect us. It is for taxing entities, at least it is as it exists right now. Senate Bill 29 is very upsetting to me specifically because it basically says you can't expend public money for lobbying activities that includes employing someone whose job it is to lobby the legislature. That one hits kind of close to home, guys. I guess there's always Barber College. I guess, I don't know. That one passed out of the Senate. We'll see what it does in the House. I do think if it does move, it'll have a lot of exceptions put into it that, you know, kind of change the nature of it and make it a little bit less troublesome. And then another one that I do think has a really good chance of passing is it requires you to take a separate vote whenever you adopt your budget on your expenditures for lobbying. So you'd have to have a separate line item. So you'd adopt your budget, and either before or after that, you'd have a separate line item laying out whatever you spend on contract for lobbying services. Yes, yes. And oddly enough, on 29 and 281, what's also interesting is not only they prohibit the political subdivision from spending money on lobbying activity, they prohibit you from joining an association that's job is to lobby. So think TML, Texas Association of Counties. So that's what they're looking at with that. And a lot of this, should be real candid, even though we're on YouTube, a lot of this is related to the public entities push back on the tax stuff that, you know, there's a lot of unhappiness. And so, you know, we'd like for you not to be able to do that anymore. And so you're seeing a lot of these bills move. And a domain, also a very busy session for this. Probably the two biggies that are the highlight eminent domain bills are House Bill 991 and Senate Bill 421. The thing about these as they relate to us is that they don't relate to us. These are for private entities. So think oil and gas pipeline companies and their use of eminent domain. So as they are drafted currently, now there's been some versions of them that brought in public entities like us, but we were taken out. They do not really apply to us as they exist today. We watch these things because eminent domain isn't something that we want to use. It's not something we use very often, but if they make changes to them, we need to make sure that we comply. Probably another big one that might affect us because we could acquire property with the idea of using it much later is how you establish actual progress before you have to sell that property back to who it was acquired from via eminent domain. They're increasing the requirements for that, so you can't just get property and hold on to it forever. You have to spend money on it. You have to go after permits. There's a whole host of things that you have to do to prove that you're going to use that property versus just take it and hold on to it. Again, I would say from the standpoint of the legislative negotiations on this, it's really, really crowded space, meaning that we're watching it. Are we engaged in the day-to-day discussions? No, because the larger entities, and particularly the private companies, are very engaged on these issues. So we're going to watch and see what they come up with.
How is it, just the 991-21, is that somewhat slanted at high-speed rail?
A little bit. Mm-hmm. There's some of that. Yep. Last but not least, well, nobody cares about this one, right? The Allen's Creek bill. So we passed out of the House 143-5. We were over in the Senate, sat for a week or so, which is pretty normal, and we were referred to committee last Wednesday. We are expecting to get a hearing relatively quickly, hopefully in the next week or so. Don't know the exact day. And then we'll just kind of see what our chances are in the Senate. I think we're going to have a little bit more of a difficult time there because, you know, there's some more personalities to deal with. So we'll just see. But, you know, the thing that I would tell you on bills like this is momentum swings. It goes back and forth. You know, we've had a lot of momentum in our favor, you know, recently. We'll see if that continues. It might change. But, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic that, you know, we have a really good chance of getting something done. Our goal in all of this, even though a lot of this has been led by the industry folks who want to use this water, is that, you know, we've been really consistent that we don't want to leave the session with nothing. Okay, so, you know, we can't go back to the way that it was because that'll delay the project even further than it's already been delayed. So hopefully we'll get something done. We'll keep you all posted on that one. Be happy to answer any questions. If I don't have any more slides, but I don't think I do. Oh, that's it.
You have a question down
yes,
here?
Sir.
Back on page 4, we talked about groundwater regulation. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate just a little? Who's being regulated there?
So this, a lot of these bills are to, for lack of a better term, control some of the ability that the legislature has given groundwater districts to regulate groundwater. I think there's the thought that the state has vested the regulation of groundwater in these local districts, but that some of them have done more than they should in terms of regulating the resource. And in many cases, according to some, it's not an opinion I share, but regulated it too much or too little or just too differently across the board. And so it's seeking to try to create some sort of consistency in how they can and can't regulate the resource.
Okay, so if our local irrigation district, could they be overridden by this law?
No. This would apply to local groundwater districts, and it's only districts that manage and regulate groundwater. So it's not irrigation districts or special utility districts or us or any of those. So it's just GCDs.
Okay.
So, but if that district is a groundwater regulation district, then yes, I mean, it would apply to them.
How might that affect the size, the San Antonio water permit that they already have in there, building pipelines?
Probably wouldn't, because most of the changes in these regulations apply to permits that were issued on or after the effective date of the bill. So most of what's in existence right now wouldn't be affected by this. It would be for future permits. But to the extent that they have a transport permit in addition to an operations permit, some of this would apply to them, probably to their benefit, and that it would allow their transport permit to be extended for as long as their operations permit.
Matt, we appreciate all the hard work. I expect that we will come this summer and you will tell us how we can move forward with Allen's group.
I hope so,
confidence.
Too. I hope so. We'll see.
All right.